Hi, I'm Almaz Muscatwala, and I am the Executive Director of Faith Forward Dallas. I'm a community leader, and you're listening to Race, Violence, and Medicine episode.
Yes, you got it. Welcome. I am Dr. Brian H. Williams, surgeon, speaker, activist, and your host for Race, Violence, and Medicine. Now, I just want to set the scene for you now. We're sitting in a Paradise Bakery and Cafe with our honored guest, which is Almaz Muscatwala. She is a rock star here in Dallas when it comes to the intersection of faith and social justice. So we're continuing our series with faith leaders in Dallas and talking about the work that they're doing in this social justice space. So Almaz, thank you for taking time out today.
Thank you so much for having me, Dr. Brian. This is just an absolute delight, and I'm just so honored to be here. Thank you.
All right, let's start off. I see you around town at all of the events that have to do with service to humanity. And actually, one of your quotes you talk about is that there's only two things worthy in life. That's faith in God and service to humanity. Tell us about that.
So I come from a faith tradition, which is a Shia Ismaili Muslim tradition, and the notion of service and volunteerism is really, really big in my faith. I was taught that the best way to worship God is by serving the humanity. So it almost talks about your vertical relationship and your horizontal relationship. And essentially, there is a worldview. The worldview, and in that they say that your vertical and your horizontal relationship. So your relationship with divine and your relationship with the community, and then it also includes the environment. So what you're doing to the earth, what you're doing to the environment, all of those components become very, very important. And since, like, we all know that we all have an idea of God, but at the end of the day, we're all exploring and trying to understand God. So I think it's almost like finding God in people. And if we believe that, you know, God, human beings are created in the image of God, it's almost like I every day try to find God in the way I interact with people. And it fascinates me. It seems like a very nice, fun, almost like an aspirational idea. But for me, it is such a big reality that it's funny that every morning when I wake up, that just what drives me, you know, to get out of my bed and, you know, be out in the world doing stuff. So and I also entertain and fascinated by the idea of, like, the diversity that I see among people as well. So that also kind of gives me a lot of thrill. And so this notion of service is very brilliant idea in my faith tradition. And so I've seen my mom, my grandfather, you name everybody in my life I have seen who has lived the best way they've thought that their life was meaningful when they were serving others. And this is like my journey where I'm finding God through my interactions with people. So that's my idea.
Yeah, I like how you describe the vertical and the horizontal. And in the horizontal, you mentioned there's people, but it's also
environment.
The environment. And it's easy to forget that sometimes, that it's not just that there's more to faith than just what we see before us.
Absolutely.
So, I mean, you're involved in quite a bit. You chair several boards that have to deal with the Muslim faith. You work for Thanksgiving Square. Tell us about the work you're doing, and I know you probably can't talk about all of it, but how would you encapsulate that succinctly for someone that wants to know just exactly how busy you are and what you're accomplishing?
That's a tough one, but let's kind of give it a shot. So I would say that I think with Thanksgiving Square particularly, I have a very interesting connection, purely because it's all about gratitude. I mean, the square was built on the notion of gratitude.
And I'm sorry, just for someone who may not know what Thanksgiving Square is, can you give us a little bit of background?
Sure. So it's an iconic building in the heart of downtown. It has a chapel, it has a park, and it also has a museum. And it was built right around the time when Dallas was let's not kind of, I wouldn't like to associate that idea of, you know, Dallas associated with hate, but I think it was around that time when JFK was assassinated and some of the visionaries of our Dallas business people came together and they thought of creating this space. And the whole idea behind Thanksgiving Square is a sanctuary or a place where people from diverse people, faith traditions and cultures could come together in one space on the common ground of gratitude, you know. And interestingly enough, that was the vision. But obviously, when you think about gratitude, there are so many different ways in which you want to actualize that gratitude. So how do you live that gratitude in action? And that's when, in my capacity as the chair of the Interfaith Council, which I'm still chairing that position, and we have 26 faith denominations represented there. Typically, those people are like lay kind of individuals, but they represent like a very interesting group of diverse faith and cultures. And in that capacity as the chair, we thought of this idea of bringing clergy group together, because right when, I think it was around 2015, is when you know, this shooting that happened in Garland in response to Prophet Muhammad's cartoon competition that happened. And, you know, in my capacity as the chair, I thought that if the Dallas mayor wanted to actually have a clergy group come together, where would he go? Where was that group in existence if he wanted to bring the faith communities together? And we realized that, you know, the mayor already had this, what do you call that? Churches council that no. That was there, but it was predominantly they were made up of Christians. So there wasn't like this very multi-faith, you know, group of, you know, faith leaders. And that's when this idea of, you know, Faith Forward Dallas was originated. And we used to be called like multi-faith task force then. And now obviously we are called Faith Forward Dallas at Thanksgiving Square. And the whole idea of Faith Forward Dallas is to respond to some of the crises in Dallas in terms of the social crisis. I would also say that Faith Forward Dallas also has become the moral voice for the community. Literally, it's almost like peeking into your soul and like literally shaking yourself and saying that, am I in the right direction? Is this morally right? Is this ethically right? Some of those very fundamental questions that I feel as a city we're supposed to ask ourselves, I think Faith Forward Dallas is asking those questions. And as far as the Interfaith Council is concerned, it does more kind of education piece where I provide opportunities for one faith group to kind of get to know the other. So we visit different congregations and we do festival of faiths and we do cultural things. So more like understanding faith from a cultural standpoint versus Faith Forward Dallas does more like a social justice work. But again, on the premise is more moral and ethical. And literally our tagline is faith leaders united for justice and compassion. So it's kind of interesting, you know, to situate both aspects, you know, which are important. Like, there are times when the best way to express your justice is just by showing compassion, you know? And that's where, like, a bunch of ridiculous amount of charity work that we do in our city really becomes very, very relevant, right? And then, and the other end, you know, your social justice work, this is exactly where, you know, all the things that, you know, I hopefully we'll talk about becomes very, very relevant, you know? The dignity of the human being becomes very, very critical.
So I want to talk about that. What does social justice mean to you? Because it means different things to many people. Yeah. And to some, it's a dirty word.
Sure.
And to others, it is the reason for being. So how would you define it?
So interestingly, again, like from my faith tradition, I belong to, again, Shia Ismaili Muslim. And justice is extremely important. It's a premise, you know, on which our faith is. But the notion of justice from the Islamic standpoint is when you restore somebody else's dignity, is when you have, you've restored justice, you know. And there's a lot of restoration and there's a lot of reconciliation that you have to do. And that's the idea of justice, where you do the civil society work in such a fashion where you restore somebody else's life, is the way Islam defines social justice. But interestingly enough, the work that we do at Faith Forward Dallas and a bunch of other social justice organizations, I think the idea is to do a lot of advocacy and a lot of almost activist kind of a role that people are taking, purely because I think I'm beginning to realize with the work that I'm doing here that half the time people just don't know the issue, and I'm included. I live in Plano. I'm on like an illusionary side of Dallas. So if I didn't have an opportunity to be part of Thanksgiving Foundation and be engaged in the work that the foundation's doing, I would be completely ignorant or have no preview of, you know, what is happening in the south side of the Dallas. So I feel like ignorance is one big part. And so the work that we do, it may seem like more like activist and more advocacy work, but then it highlights the issue, right, for a lot of people. And there are several ways in which, you know, you can highlight the issue. You could do it, you know, through media, through newspapers, you know, writing books, you know, panel conversations. But then there is also an element of marches, you know. People have very different ways in which, you know, people choose, you know, to assert, you know, for social justice. But that's one idea personally for my own sake. My most part of my life, I have chosen peace over justice. So literally, I would...
So you say you're peace over justice. So help me with that, because I would think that those two go together. That's an interesting statement right there.
So, I mean, it's where I am growing as a person, and I have no qualms saying that, because one has to be honest about these ideas before you even proclaim to say that, you know, I'm going to be restoring somebody else's justice. So in my personal life, if there's a conflict, and if there is a disagreement, or if fundamentally I disagree, you know, on something, I believe in two approaches. First, I believe in negotiation, dialogue, sharing perspectives. Like, I bank on this whole idea of education, like this whole premise of, like, let's talk about it. Can we resolve by talking it out? You know, can we come up, you know, with a solution where, you know, you and I can come on the common ground and, you know, think beyond ourselves and our differences and come up, you know, to the real issue and, you know. So that's one idea of, you know, peace restoration that I like to do. And the other is that I also have this ultimate belief that inherently you could try as much as you like, but unless the other person's ready to understand your viewpoint, it is a futile exercise. Like, if you've realized certain things in life, other person hasn't realized, and that journey of that person to realize where you are, not being righteous about your understanding of a certain thing, but not claiming, how do you claim not to be righteous about certain thing, but at the same time, you know, have a ground in which you say that there is reality to that. You know, how do you reconcile not being righteous, but at the same time, you know, saying that there is truth and reality to that particular issue. And I feel like that's a bigger, like, it's very multi-layered, and I have trouble, you know, just understanding. So that's how I define peace, is where I will talk, I will negotiate, I will provide a lot of education. I believe in the power of the person coming, you know, to the terms, you know, if they have to. So I don't necessarily jump onto negating the other person's viewpoint, however crazy that person's idea of that same issue could be. Like, I feel like if I want to genuinely come to consensus on a particular issue, it requires for me to genuinely understand that other person's viewpoint, which is, like, so different from mine. And what caused that person to be that at that, you know, in that point and at that perspective, that I'm so different from that. And for me, coming that real justice is when you're able to come to that point of understanding. Otherwise, there's a lot of action. Like, you know, there's a lot, like, we're doing stuff, but I don't know there's enough bridge building that's happening. And that's where I feel like the peace and justice. So I devote a lot of time in explaining myself.
Right. Well, that's good. So I want to pick up on that thread there where you talked about starting the conversation. And you mentioned you live in Plano, which, you know, for those of you who don't know, that's a suburb north of Dallas. And you mentioned South Dallas. So there's a different demographic difference as far as wealth and race. And I would say that one part is wanting to talk, or another part is done talking. They want some action. So let's pick up with that after we take a break. You're listening to Race, Violence, and Medicine. Our guest is Almas Maskotwala. She's a faith leader here in Dallas, as well as someone who's walking the walk and talking the talk and walking the walk when it comes to interfaith work and social justice. Stick with us. We'll be back in a moment. Welcome back to Race, Violence, and Medicine. I am Dr. Brian H. Williams. Our guest today is Almas Maskotwala. She's a faith leader here in Dallas doing work in social justice. And we've been having a great conversation about her role in healing in the city of Dallas. And Almas, before the break, we talked about how you feel that dialogue is important to, and if I'm putting words in your mouth, let me know. The dialogue is important to bridging gaps between individuals that have different perspectives. So before we answer that question, I want to learn more about you and your upbringing and your background. So tell us about yourself.
I was born, brought up, got educated, got married, had both my boys in India, Mumbai. And I've studied psychology, my undergrad in psychology, and then my master's in child development. And the idea of conflict always fascinated me, so I did my certification at SMU, the Dispute and Conflict Resolution. So that's kind of my brief educational background.
Tell me more about that dispute and conflict resolution. That sounds interesting.
Yeah. So that's a program that's offered, was offered at the SMU in Legacy campus, but now they've moved that entire program to the SMU in Dallas. But this whole program is all about resolving conflict between two individuals and also international conflicts as well. And that's when I was first introduced to the conflict. Not that I had not heard about it in the news, but this conflict between Israel and Palestine. And I still remember Dr. Rainey introduced this idea, and I was so fascinated, and I knew at that point that that's where I belong, and so obviously in dispute and conflict resolution we also talked about negotiation and reconciliation, restoration. We have looked at case studies of, you know, people who were murdered, you know, by other individuals, and through the process of reconciliation, people have actually forgiven and restored their own pain and healing through this process.
Okay, I now need to hear more about this reconciliation. Sure. Because I talk a lot about, you know, racial reconciliation in this country, and I'm not the only person that's out there talking about this, but it's something I discuss. But it leads to a sometimes confrontational discussion, but and also many times challenging discussion about what does that actually mean and how do you achieve that, particularly when it comes to racial reconciliation in our country with the legacy of slavery and racism and, you know, all that is still baked into the fabric of American society.
So I do realize that when you talk about reconciliation, it almost seems like an idea where you're not really getting to the crux of the problem, but the reconciliation is happening at a very superfluous level. And that's what, for me, I strongly believe that you cannot do two things in other person's life. One, you cannot heal the other person. The second, you cannot bring happiness to other person's life. These two things, the person's responsible themselves. And if you can speak from an individual standpoint that I'm responsible for my healing and I'm responsible for my happiness, then there is only so much intervention that people can bring in someone else's life. And if I think the society and America and the community and Dallas particularly were to operate on that lens of helping people realize that you're responsible for your destiny, sounds like an idealistic idea, there's idealism in here, but I feel there is reality to it. And anything that is transformative requires a lot of work, not just from people who want to provide reconciliation, but also the ones who need reconciliation. And I feel like most of the time what I'm seeing in Dallas is like one group of people blaming the other for their destiny. And I think I believe in being responsible for your own destiny. You know, there's only so much. There is a verse in the Quran where Allah says that even God cannot help you until you decide to, you know, do something about it. And that doing something about it is not, again, having expectations of what the others can do for you. Like, typically, that's how you would interpret that. What is the other person doing for me? But it is almost like, what do I want to do out of my life? And if God tells you that you're responsible, then that is the same expectation that you should have from the society. I may be completely off in so many other people in Dallas whose idea of reconciliation is that someone else has to do something. For me, but I just feel like we need to provide platforms. And I don't know, like, I haven't studied, you know, I don't claim to understand this idea very well, but I just want to reference Nelson Mandela. You know, this whole South Africa, it seems like if you study that there was some kind of reconciliation that happened, you know. And I feel like there is a model in which, you know, one could apply that for America as well and for the city of Dallas as well. And I think that requires for all the organizations that, you know, all the individuals, all the communities are interested in, you know, doing some good in the community. And this idea of social justice also should be reconciliation. And in that, you avoid, allow these platform of dialogues to happen where you share your pain with the other person. And then you allow the other person to, you know, forgive you, or you forgive the other person. And until you don't break through that cycle, it is a part of the history that you're gonna carry forward. And as much as we like to something that you've inherited, like I've inherited so many things from my parents, so I can abandon that, but I do know what I can make out of, you know, things that I've inherited that can benefit me. So say, for example, even something as adverse as slavery, you know, okay, there is a theory, again, there is a notion that I believe very strongly, again, and I've lived it, okay? I've lived all of this that I'm saying. That people who come from a very, like my husband, I hope he doesn't mind me referencing him, but I'm sure he's going to be okay. But he...
You know, I'll be happy if he's actually listening to my show, so...
he would be an interesting, yeah. So anyway, he grew up in a very... very conducive environment where he came from a very affluent upbringing. He had just about everything in his life. But his aspirations for life, he's not as driven as I am compared to my life, where literally my mom had to sell jewelry that she owned, you know, to get me educated. So I come from that very humble upbringing. And the drive that I have, and he sees the drive in me, and he's like... So he said, I had everything and you didn't have anything. But when we compare our lives, he feels like I'm more driven, you know, to do things. And even now, like our standards of the assessment that we make about our lives, he thinks that I have achieved more than, you know, what he has achieved in his life. The point that I'm making, and my son would validate that as well. So then sometimes when you're deprived of something in life, you have a whole different drive to life, and you're driven more, and you understand the value of everything that you have in your life. So say, let's take that entire reference that I made to my personal life, to slavery, a very adverse, very tragic, very detrimental to someone's life or someone's race, community. How do you cultivate such a detrimental part of your history into a positive strength for yourself, right? How do you cultivate that? Because that is a reality to your life. You cannot abandon that. You cannot go away from that. That's part of your identity. How do you cultivate that into your, you know, positive? I think that's What I find interesting in that example is that people who were treated, with less dignity, understand the value of dignity far more. Okay, their attitude towards value for life, value for money, value for education, everything that was you deprived of, and now when you have it, you see it so differently. And you are a richer person because you understand those things very intimately. Those are not just concepts and ideas. They are very real to you. And I feel like at the end of the day, those individuals are richer and fuller, and they are able to make... they contribute life in a whole different fashion, you know, and I don't know how to explain that even something that detrimental can also be used, you know, to your benefit.
Well, I think there's a complete absence of adequate education within our schools about that. I mean, people need to know, and just talking about it and educating our children about it, adults would grow up much more informed, and that is a path forward. But to give it short shrift and not the attention that I believe it fully deserves is doing a disservice to our children and to humanity. So I want to get back to, I haven't even talked a whole lot about the work you're doing as a faith leader. And you said you're Shiite Muslim. Now, just talk to us about just educate us about this, because there's a lot of negative rhetoric going on right now in our country, and there's misconceptions about Shia and Sunni, am I saying it correctly, Muslim. So, I don't know, give us just break it down for us so that we understand what it is and what the debate is about within the Muslim community, and also between Christians and Jews and Muslims. That's maybe like a PhD course there, but what can you do for us in a few minutes?
Yeah, absolutely. let's give it a shot. So,
does that make sense? What I'm just asking?
Absolutely. I would love to talk about that. So, right after the death of Prophet Muhammad, there is a group of individuals. The community believed that Prophet Allah ordained Prophet to declare his successor, and that group came to be known as the Shias, because Allah ordained Prophet to declare Hazrat Ali, who was his son-in-law, who was married to his daughter, and he became the first Imam for the Shia Muslims. And there is the other group, which is Sunni, which makes up the 85% of the total population of Muslims, believe that it is the Quran and the Sunnah, which is the way Prophet conducted himself, and his hadith, which means everything that he said, are the three reference points for the community to be guided. And that's when, you know, this is the two kind of, so Shias believe in the notion of succession through Hazrat Ali, and the Sunnis believe in, you know, Quran and the Sunnah and the hadiths of Prophet, which means the sayings of Prophet. Interestingly enough, there's quite a bit of history, 1,400 years of history between, death of Prophet Muhammad and up until this point. There are a lot of splits that happen within the Shia denomination and within Sunnis as well. But I represent the Shia Ismaili denomination of Islam, which is the second largest Shia branch of Islam. And interestingly enough, I have a present living Imam who is a direct descendant of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. So he finds his direct lineage to Prophet Muhammad through his son-in-law, Hazrat Ali. And so the notion of Imam in the Shia Ismaili faith tradition is that he's a spiritual lineage. He has a spiritual lineage, and he's the authority of the entire 15 million Ismaili Muslims that are across the globe. we are culturally very, very diverse. We live in almost 29 countries across the globe, and we are all united by our allegiance to His Highness the Aga Khan.
Okay, so forgive me if I'm getting this correct. I want to paraphrase, make sure I understand. Shia,
Ismaili,
Prophet Muhammad, Sunni, Quran is the, that may be very simplistic, but that is where you find your spiritual teachings and direction. Is that correct?
Yeah. So Shias and Sunnis believe in the unity of God, which is the Tawheed. Okay. Shias and Sunnis both believe in prophethood. They both believe in Prophet. The only difference is that the Shias believe in the succession of Hazrat Ali and the lineage after that, versus the Prophets, the Sunnis believe that, you know, the leadership ended right after the death of Prophet Muhammad. Mm-hmm. So there was no continuation that happened. So their reference point for the 85% of the people to be guided, their reference point is Quran, the Sunnah, and the scholarship, you know, that prevailed at that time, and obviously the Hadith of Prophet Muhammad.
So what is the significance of that different belief today in 2019?
Very interesting. Like, Islam is a mosaic. And Islam is not just a faith, but it's also a civilization. Because in the 1400 years of history, Islam traveled to so many different lands. And the beauty, Islam is a thinking religion. Islam is a very spiritual faith. And what binds the Sunnis and the Shias today is the ethical parameters, and obviously the Tawheed and the Nabuwa, which is believing in one God. And, you know, and interestingly enough, like I was telling my son just 2 days ago, that the whole idea of oneness is also not one singularity of God. It is not one as in one, but the unity of God, wherein I feel that unity which I was referencing earlier, right, of why I feel that I can find God through people, is because this idea of Tawheed, where unity is being united with the universe, you know, and that's where. So we are both kind of on the common ground of ethics
Right. So I mean, I know it's not fair to try to compress thousands of years of religion into a few minutes. That's just not a fair question to ask, but I was trying to get a better understanding of that. So that talks about the within Islam. Now let's talk about some of the external forces. I don't know if that's force is probably not a good word, but the negative rhetoric that we hear nowadays regarding Islam, and, you know, Jewish faith, Christian faith, and Islam, and how those three interact.
So that's, you know, in fact, I think we find our roots not just within Islam, but we find our roots in the Abrahamic faith to Prophet Ibrahim. And we call it Ibrahim and Abrahamic faith, where we all are kind of the common denominator for the Christians and the Jews and Muslims is that we are monotheistic. We all believe in the unity of God, and that just kind of binds the three most diverse, you know, faiths, you know, in the world on this common ground. And we have our roots, you know, to Prophet Ibrahim, and I think that is one premise on which, you know, we can bring the entire humanity, you know, together. So that's one very interesting, you know, thing to remember. The other aspect, it's very interesting that I find every time I go to Temple Emmanuel, I'm fascinated that there are 15 million Jews in the world, and the Shia Ismaili Muslims are 15 million. So the numbers of Jews and number of Ismaili Muslims is like exact same number. And we make up just 1% of the entire 1 billion. But it's interesting that, we revere Jesus and Moses as our prophets. So just the way we would recite Salawat, which is like we offer our reverence to Prophet Muhammad, we offer the same reference to Prophet Moses. We call him Musa, you know, Prophet Musa and Prophet Isa, and we revere them as prophets. And they are referenced more in Quran than Prophet Muhammad. And the interesting part also is that there is a whole chapter in Quran on Mary, you know, and the birth of Jesus is described exactly the way it is. Exactly, yeah. So this whole idea of the miracle of Jesus' birth is quite a fascinating. There's a whole chapter on that.
So it's the same in the Quran as it is in the Bible, or is that what you're saying to me?
This idea of her being born without a man, okay, with the mercy of God, because God, you know, there's this idea in Islam which is called Amra, which is Amra is his authority. God said be and it became. Right. This whole idea of be and become is where God said be and the birth of Jesus happened. So it substantiated the power, you know, in a whole different way for Muslims, because this whole idea that God created this world, you know, the way he wanted, like he could create, you know, but we revere, you know, Jesus and Mary and their reference, you know. And so it fascinates me sometimes when you want to look for commonality between these three monotheistic faiths. There's so much more commonality that we could celebrate, right?
So I've learned that there is much more that unites us than divides us. So what a great lesson. And I'll remember what you said, that social justice is baked into Islam, and it's about restoring someone else's dignity. Thank you for sharing that. Almas Maskatwala, our guest here today on Race, Violence, and Medicine, I appreciate your time. Now, if our guests wanted to find you later, is there a way that they can contact you?
Yeah. I think the best way to get me would be my...
Don't give out your phone number.
So I think my email is really long.
Where can they track you down on LinkedIn or something like that?
Yeah. I mean, easily you can absolutely find me on LinkedIn. Almas Maskatwala is how I'm listed. And then, yeah, I guess I look forward to being in conversation with a bunch of other people who are going to be listening to this.
All right, I'll make sure I spell out the name in the show notes. So check it out at raceviolencemedicine.com. And you can hear this podcast anywhere you get your podcasts. So please share with your family and friends. And also make sure you go check out my website, brianwilliamsmd.com. That's Brian with an I. And I will keep you up to date on the latest episodes of the show, my blog, my latest op-eds I've been putting out there. So brianwilliamsmd.com, and you keep track of that. Once again, I appreciate you. Thank you for tuning in. This concludes our show for today. All right, this is Dr. Brian H. Williams. Welcome back to Race, Violence, and Medicine. I told you we were done, but we are not. I'm sitting here listening to Almas give me a masterclass on social justice, so we're turning the mic back on. So let's get back to it, Almas. Tell me what you go preach. Keep preaching.
So I think the biggest, you know, thing that I want to reference, because it just happened, which is, you know, Confederate monuments. And we have had a success where, you know, the city council voted to remove, you know, the Confederate monuments. My challenge and my struggle internal, you know, is how do you explain when we try to achieve, like, it may seem like that we've had a success in that, but do you think we've compromised on a lot of other things, you know, that needed to be paid attention to?
So let me just frame that. You're talking about the removal of the Confederate monuments here in Dallas, which is a debate going on all across the country.
Right.
But recently there was a vote to actually remove the remaining monuments here in Dallas, and you were part of that effort to make that happen.
Yes. Thank you. So I think the disagreement that I have, and more than disagreement, my own kind of personal, I'm grappling with this idea that how do you it's going to take thousands of dollars, for us to remove it and then find an alternate place where we're going to save it. And I'm pretty sure the city council had the same argument that I'm giving. Almost sounds like I'm not in favor of removal. But my question too is that does that guarantee or restore someone's dignity? And there are a range of opinion that people can have on that. And I am an Indian Muslim, very privileged person who may completely be missing a point, in making this statement. But if I were to bring in complete objectivity to this, purely because there are some financial resources involved, I challenge, all those people who struggle and who want to bring about some kind of justice in our town, and restore people's dignity. Can that be restored by actually investing that same money into improving the quality of life of the people, giving access to education, giving access to healthcare, giving access to better, better mental health, or so many other things that could be invested in. Now, obviously, every time I give this response to any time we talk about justice, people tell me that Dallas is very good about doing charity. We know how to provide food, and we know how to provide shelter. We do a lot of charity, and we don't know justice. And my question to them is, and I think my understanding from my faith tradition, the best way to show your justice is when you've improved the quality of the life of the people in a sustainable way. So the charity that you see in Dallas is where I get kicks out of the fact that I have made a contribution in someone else's life, but it is a short-term contribution that I'm making. The day when we decide that I have a sustainable approach to someone else's change in life is when I think that charity is where I want to be invested in.
I'm sitting there shaking my head like emphatically, yes. It can't be episodic, right? It needs to be something that is sustainable and that transcends generations. That's when you have known you truly make a difference. And about the Confederate monuments, I have an opinion. I actually wrote an op-ed that was published in the Dallas Morning News. I wrote that a little over a year ago after the Charlottesville incident occurred, because that's when the debate was starting to heat up here in Dallas as well. So if you go to Dallas Morning News and you Google just Dr. Brian H. Williams Confederate Monuments, you can read my opinion that I wrote about that. But I was connected. I had a connection to the Virginia thing because that's my home state and living here in Dallas. So I shared my perspective on that. And got some interesting feedback from both sides. But that's the whole point. At least they read it, right? Yeah. At least they read it. So, okay, Almas, for real this time, we're gonna close it out. Thank you again for being accommodating when I said to record this second or this impromptu segment. And again, thank you all for tuning in. I'll check in with you next week.